You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Wednesday, May 26, 2021. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps and steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Elizabeth Hinton, Associate Professor of History and African American Studies at Yale University, Professor of Law at Yale Law School, author of America on Fire, The Untold History of Police Violence and Black Rebellion Since the 1960s. Also on the program, speaking of law, grand jury convened in the Trump criminal probe. What do you get the ex-president who has everything? His own grand jury, ladies and gentlemen. Meanwhile, Health and Human Services head Becerra calls for a follow-up investigation on the origins of COVID-19. Joe Biden reportedly willing to nearly halve his infrastructure ask as the bipartisan kabuki continues. And surprise, vaccine makers lobby other countries to oppose a patent waiver, which would make it easier for poorer countries to vaccinate their folks. Pentagon is accelerating its Afghan exit. The Wisconsin Republican Party kills the state's Medicaid expansion without any accountability in their extremely gerrymandered state. And the heartwarming story of the U.S. Senate giving Jeff Bezos' space ambitions a bailout. Ireland quashes Biden's global minimum tax proposal. Trump's EPA apparently hid threats of a toxic herbicide. And Tony Blinken announces $110 million in aid to Gaza, where 400,000 people have limited access to fresh drinking water. All this and more on today's Majority Report. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. Thanks for joining us. Joining me, as always, Emma Vigeland. Hello, Emma.
Hello, Sam. How are you?
Wow. Okay. Look, if you don't want to ask, you don't. I'm not making you ask. That's like the tone that, honestly, my kids use, like when I've just said, like, you know, brush your teeth. Fine.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's kind of the dynamic we've got today.
I'm not asking. You don't have to ask me. I wear it on my sleeve.
Yeah.
So move on. Right. I guess we'll just move right on from there.
Yes, let's do that.
We were just talking before the show started as to who are some of the most stupid senators in the U.S. Senate, and there's, you know, there's heavy competition with no doubt. I mean, I think like Tommy Tuberville, is that how we pronounce his name?
Yes.
I mean, I think there's no doubt that Tommy Tuberville is at least the least informed as to how the government functions of any senator. And I mean, by government functions, I'm talking like Schoolhouse Rock level knowledge.
Doesn't understand what the three branches of government are.
What's
right.
A bill? What are the three branches of government? Whatever could fit into a 60-second song geared towards children to teach them about civics is above the pay grade, apparently, except for not the pay grade, of Tommy Tuberville. That is, and then there's a couple others, but Marco Rubio is got to be sort of somewhere there at the top of it. He's just, you know, he's little Marco. And here he is on, and here's little Marco. And understand what's going on here, right? I mean, just recall that Marco Rubio 6-8 years ago was considered the new Republican Party. He was one of the
wunderkind to save the Republicans, the next guy up.
The one of the young guns who was coming up and going to show the party. Remember, he was a big proponent of immigration reform until he had to bail when he realized, like, oh my gosh, I guess I thought I had joined a different Republican Party. And he bailed. He just dropped the thing like a hot potato. The whole thing fell apart. And he was also trying to maintain that brand when Donald Trump showed up on the scene. He was one of the biggest critics of Donald Trump. Bigger critic than even Ted Cruz until Donald Trump made fun of Ted Cruz's wife. And then Ted Cruz for 15 minutes was a critic of Donald Trump's.
And don't forget about the water incident.
That's right. Yeah. Okay. Well, so he's got a little dry mouth and Donald Trump mocked him. And, you know, I guess, I don't know. I think they compared their organ size on a in a debate. But be that as it may, Marco Rubio knows he's now facing more than likely Val Demings. Could actually be a race for the Senate in Florida. Rubio is not the strongest candidate. And so he's going to have to go all in on the Trump agenda. And what does that mean? And by Trump agenda, I mean the Republican Party agenda. Let's be honest. And what does that mean? On the day after the anniversary of the killing of George Floyd, show up on Fox and Friends and show how you are just going to have none of this.
That's what they call social justice. That's the brand and that's the name they've created for it. But what it really is it's neo-Marxism. What it really is cultural Marxism. It is another way to tear apart capitalism and the American way of life.
So are you okay with that school in your state doing that?
No, I don't think we should be teaching that. I think here's what I think we should be teaching people at universities. I think we should be teaching them engineering. I think we should be teaching them biology. I think we should be teaching them science, engineering, math, other technological fields. I think we should be teaching people the skills they need to find a good paying job and contribute to their community, their families,
right, exactly,
and their country in the 21st century. That's why we have universities. That's why we have college degrees, not to train a generation of cultural Marxist activists, but to train people so they can go out and find jobs that are good for them, good for their families,
right,
and good for the country. That's why we do this and why we should be subsidizing, why the American taxpayer, why the Florida's taxpayers should be subsidizing teaching our young students how to hate America, how to hate everything about our history, how to divide and hate one another, how our identity is not American, but the color of our skin. Why we should be spending taxpayer money to teach these things that are destructive, not to mention untrue, is beyond me. I don't understand why that's happening, and I hope it's corrected.
Well, I mean, Matt hit the nail on the head, right? He doesn't understand why it's happening because he believes that the only purpose of education is essentially to indoctrinate college students, students in general, to serve capital and to serve capitalism and the status quo and the system in and of itself. Sam, are you back?
I am back. Yes.
So, I mean, you watched that clip before the show anyway, but I was just building on Matt's great point, which is essentially that the only service of education in Marco Rubio's mind is to give people the explicit tools to serve capitalism in ways that don't actually question power centers in any fashion. And that's the undercurrent beneath the just goofy whatever he's talking about, cultural Marxism nonsense terms that he made up.
Well, and I was just struck. I've never, you know, the idea you don't teach literature, you don't teach English, you don't teach history, according to him. No, everything, the university to him and our schools are just, like you say, vocational schools to gear people out to be worker bees. And that's it, according to him. And then in the middle of this, like, you know, he does a beautiful example of form and function coming together to show the danger of what he's proposing. You have senators who go on television and start bringing up words and concepts that nobody knows what they mean. Like, I've never even heard of like what social Marxism. I don't know what that means. He just sort of just was winging it. And I think that's part of the problem when you don't have any social sciences that you're teaching students. Yeah. You start getting
I'd be curious as to how many science and engineering courses that Marco Rubio took when he went to college, because one could say if he didn't take enough, he might be sympathetic to cultural Marxism.
He got a degree in political science. And he's putting that to work. He goes and he gets a job as a senator. There you go.
There. Well, you know, I guess he did follow that stricter pipeline there.
Here's a prediction. We're going to see a lot more Marco Rubio on Fox talking like this, because it is the formula of the Republican Party to motivate people. And you're going to see him get more and more and closer to the line of really making this about, you know, the social justice warriors. And because he's, you know, one of the things that's going to make it hard for him to run against Val Demings, and I'm not necessarily the biggest fan of hers, although I think she's going to have a good opportunity to pick up the seat in Florida, is that she's a former cop, former chief of police. Makes it a little bit hard for him to cast her as being anti-police, which would have been the thing that he would have probably run on. But now it's got to be just sort of the Democratic Party is captured by the social cultural Marxists. And apparently we don't even need a description of what that is.
Well, just, I mean, they found a way to call, you know, Bernie Sanders a self-hating Jew or an anti-Semite as a Jewish man. So they may be able to just, you know, find she's a self-hating cop, Val Demings. Go. That's going to be his go-to.
one can only hope. All right. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll be talking to Elizabeth Hinton, associate professor of history and African-American studies at Yale. Also a professor of law at Yale Law School, author of America on Fire: The Untold History of Police Violence and Black Rebellion Since the 1960s. We'll be right back after this. Oh, folks, just a reminder, I wanted to check in too to see what the story was with, just to warn these guys, my internet connection seems still hinky. But all that said, folks, you can support this program by becoming a member. You become a member by going to jointhemajorityreport.com. When you do, you not only get the free show free of commercials, you also get, you support the free show and make it possible for us to bring on great guests every day. And you also get then fun half every day. So check it out. Jointhemajorityreport.com. Also, don't forget, join the Discord. A lot of great resources, a lot of great conversations there, a lot of great people, your fellow listeners of the Majority Report. Check it out, majoritydiscord.com. All right. Want to welcome to the program Associate Professor of History and African-American Studies at Yale University, a professor of law at Yale Law School, and the author of America on Fire: The Untold History of Police Violence and Black Rebellion Since the 1960s. Elizabeth Hinton, welcome to the show. I'm here with Emma Vigeland.
Thanks so much for having me, Sam.
So, all right. So let's just, this is low hanging fruit. If yours is the untold history of police violence and Black rebellion since the 1960s, what's the told history?
So the told history is that between 1964, say, and 1968, Black Americans erupted in criminal, spontaneous, carnivalesque rebellion in response to police actions in major urban centers like Harlem in 64, Watts in 65, Detroit and Newark during what's known as the long, hot summer of 1967, and the 100-some cities that erupted as kind of the last, that's seen as the last hurrah of this era of protests following the assassination of Martin Luther King Jr. And really, these events have been assessed as criminal actions that required or that necessitated increased police force in order to contain.
And so let me, and before we get to actually what the untold story is, like why this year? I mean, you start in the 60s, but why this era as opposed to, I mean, you could go back. Another 150 years. I'm not saying that. I mean, that's a lot of work. But is there a particular reason why in modernity this is a different dynamic?
Yeah. So, I mean, this is the political violence that we saw in communities of color beginning in the mid 1960s can't be separated from the larger civil rights movement. I think that's one of the things that hasn't been told in terms of how we think about this violence during this period. But, you know, when people rebelled, they shared this same grievances as the mainstream civil rights movement. These political protests were about access to decent jobs, robust educational opportunities in under-resourced communities, decent housing, essentially not to be treated like second-class citizens in their cities and country, and full political and economic inclusion. These were the same goals as the mainstream civil rights movement, as well as an end to police brutality and protection from white supremacist violence.
Why the word? I mean, let's just talk about the word rebellion as opposed to and riot. And maybe we should start with the development of the word riot as a mechanism of obscuring that connection that you're talking about.
Right. So, I mean, of course, you know, most of the collective violence, and this gets at your earlier question as well, most of the collective violence that the nation witnessed through the 20th century were white mobs who attacked Black communities, mainly in the Northeast and especially around the First and Second World War. So East St. Louis, 1917, a mob of 2,000 Black men basically attacked the Black community in East St. Louis, forcing Black families to choose between being shot to death or burned in their own homes. During the Red Summer of 1919, we see this similar kind of mob violence. And of course, we're coming up next week on the 100-year commemoration of the Tulsa riot and the massacre of the Greenwood community there. But it wasn't in the 1960s. It was when this collective violence by Black people against exploitative and exclusionary institutions surfaced that the idea of riots and criminality really began to take hold. And following Harlem in 1964, which was the first major incident of rebellion after a 15-year-old high school student was shot by a New York City police officer, President Johnson said, this violence has nothing to do with civil rights. It's a riot. It's tied to the juvenile delinquency problem in Harlem. It's criminal. And therefore, the solution is more police deployment in the community. And ever since, we've had this idea about riots linked with criminality and Black criminality in particular.
Well, yeah. And I'm just, because that word riot has done so much work and carried so much weight since that time period that you write about. And I know this is kind of pivoting a little bit, but I'm just wondering how you found that word in particular and the weight that it carried translated into, say, the messaging of like a Richard Nixon as we moved past the civil rights era and into the 70s and beyond.
That's such an important question because in, you know, framing this political violence as rioting, right, this really fueled the expansion of police forces that we witnessed during the 1960s as part of the war on crime that Lyndon Johnson called and that Richard Nixon inherited when he took the presidency. So one of the last major pieces of legislation during the Johnson administration, the Omnibus Crime Control and Safe Streets Act, started this unprecedented investment into local law enforcement that Richard Nixon, who took office shortly thereafter, basically administered. And this legislation and the programs of the war on crime facilitated the transfer of surplus military grade weapons to not just police forces in big cities, but police forces in mid-sized cities and rural communities throughout the United States. And the idea was that this equipment was a necessary riot prevention measure. So even the, you know, again, the linking of riots and criminality, the idea that the best way to prevent riots or to stop riots, right, is more police and a militarized police force really guided the strategies of the early war on crime and was an important catalyzing force for Johnson and federal policymakers to support the war on crime in the first place. Because for the first 200 some years of U.S. history, the federal government had never gotten involved directly in local law enforcement. And this has so much to do with the threat of rioting as it was framed and conceived by policymakers.
I want to get into to some of the specific points over the course of really from the 60s to now. But do you think that because, you know, and I have to say that, like, you know, we can also go back to, like, even we've been talking about this quite a bit on the program, but, like, you know, white riots, massacres in that start really in Reconstruction. Like, on some level, you start to look at the arc of history. What you're seeing is, you know, sort of this fight, in terms of who's going to control, who's going to have levers of power. A lot of those massacres were in Reconstruction were a function of Black people getting elected to office and having the opportunity to sort of, you know, have some measure of representation, self-determination, et cetera, et cetera. So, but do you think that this pivot to the federalization, to the extent that it was, of policing and the response to the response to the sort of the extension of the fight for civil rights, that this was a, you know, that it's not a coincidence that it happened when the most naked governmental systems of racism were changed, right? I mean, this, you know, we get the Civil Rights Act and we get the Voting Rights Act in 65. And so, you know, there's still obviously systemic racism. We talked to Dorothy Brown about it in taxes. We can talk, in the context of real estate and wealth disparities. But in terms of what the government is doing sort of like nakedly, allowing disenfranchisement, those are taken down. And then there is a sort of less, I don't want to say structural, but more operational a system of control that is deployed. Is that, am I reading too much into that? Or
no, I mean, I think, you know, and Sam, this gets to your earlier point. You just laid that out beautifully, because there is this tendency in U.S. history going back to Reconstruction. I think that period is really important. And thank you for drawing our attention to it, right? Because there's this tendency that every time rights and the bounds of citizenship expand to previously marginalized groups and Black Americans in particular, there's new criminal laws and new systems of incarceration that emerge immediately afterwards. So after emancipation, right, you get the Black codes that many Southern states enacted as a way to criminalize newly freed people and get them back to work for white planters in kind of a new assemblage of the plantation system in order to rebuild the South after the Civil War. And this system, known as the convict lease system, was kind of the first mass incarceration in the United States. And then literally 100 years later, Johnson calls the war on crime. This is 1 year after the Civil Rights Act passed. March 1965 calls the war on crime and then sends the Voting Rights Act to Congress. So again, you know, we see the expansion of citizenship, the dismantling of Jim Crow, and then yet this new federal intervention. And so, you know, part of it is this like flow of history that and a indication that there is a fundamental resistance on the part of policymakers to really also simultaneously supporting the kind of structural transformations to bring about true equality. Instead, right, policing and criminal law is increasingly entrusted to manage the new racial order and impose new forms of social control in communities that have immediately just received new sets of rights and new access to civic participation in the nation.
All right. Well, so let's go back and look at, like, you know, the sort of, I guess, the eras or the epochs that you list in terms of the way these rebellions evolve, as it were. I mean, 64 to 68, you know, was where you had the sort of, I guess, the ones that we that maybe were more broadly aware of, like Watts and Detroit and Newark. That are in the wake of the assassination of MLK. How do they change from that era to what you call the crucible of rebellion, which is 68 to 72?
Yeah. So, I mean, that's the untold part, right? We thought that the violence peaked in 67 and maybe in 68. But in fact, the violence peaked. That was only the beginning. The violence really peaked again after the enactment of that Safe Streets Act in 1968. And when these federal grants earlier, you know, Johnson calls the war on crime in 65. So 65 to 68, these are when the early experimental federal grants are hitting mostly big cities as riot prevention measures. And after the first piece of major national legislation is passed and an agency is set up within the Department of Justice to administer funding to local police and state governments for criminal justice planning. That's when we begin to see the kind of the breadth and scale and frequency of rebellions really occurring, because as police forces in smaller cities like Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, and Carver Ranches, Florida, and Albuquerque, New Mexico, are expanding and militarizing, and residents in segregated communities are then subjected to the kind of policing strategies that their counterparts in big cities had been experiencing, their response to that police incursion and police violence is to fight back. And so between June 68 and 1972 through 1972, there are 2,000 rebellions in big and small cities. In the period from 64 to through Martin Luther King Jr.'s assassination, there are several hundred. So again, it's really in these smaller cities that don't get the kind of coverage that the big city rebellions get, that we're seeing this political violence happening in mass. And it happens across the United States, not just in the Northeast, but in the Southern states, in the West, in the Rust Belt, the Sun Belt, you name it. You know, many of our hometowns, again, like nearly 1,000 cities experience this form of political violence. And it mostly emerged in response to the policing of ordinary everyday activities. So police officers arresting a group of kids who are hanging out in the park, police officers interfering during a family barbecue, and making just arrests in general that other community members viewed as arbitrary. So, you know, today and really from Miami in 1980 onwards, rebellions occur in response to exceptional incidents of police brutality or miscarriages of justice. But in this crucible period, what I call the crucible period of the late 60s and early 70s, it's in response to the policing of ordinary everyday activity.
And we should say you have a comprehensive list in the book that you've included in the appendix of those 2000 rebellions. And so just to be clear, so we have that period of 64 to 68, and then 68, the police force is, maybe it's too much to say it's federalized, but it mm-hmm. is policing is in some mm-hmm. ways federalized in some manner. And it is that which creates, it's almost like a in virtuous circle, but it creates the pressures there. How much of that history is lost or was conflated with what was going on in terms of Vietnam and in terms of like the hippie culture, or how much was playing into that? I mean, I just you know, recall growing up, I know that there were you know, what was, you know, I was taught as a riot in my hometown of Worcester, Massachusetts around that time in Great Brook Valley. But Abbie Hoffman was also on the scene just because he happened to live in that city. And so he was there. But I wonder if these things get conflated, that there is a sort of a on some level, a political agenda against the police. But then there's also just sort of like a, hey, you're messing with my like my daily life. That is not so much a I don't want to say it's not a political agenda, but it's sort of like almost like it's a quality of life issue.
Right. So there's a lot going on there. I mean, I think one in the within the kind of mainstream American imagination, this is true in the earlier period of rebellion too. The political violence just kind of leads to this sense of, among many, of anarchy and chaos, with continued protests on the streets, with a rising student anti-war movement going on, and many prominent radical and revolutionary organizations. I think from the perspective of policymakers, and many local, you know, at all levels, right? There's a insistence that rebellion is that somehow groups like the Black Panthers and the Black Liberation Army are inciting the rebellion, and that it's really outside agitators that are fueling it. But I think, and this is one of the things that the research really shows, that for the people who participated, who felt they had no recourse but to, you know, throw a rock or a bottle at a police officer or burn a building or loot, this was really the outgrowth of, again, larger socioeconomic grievances, in part because in every city where rebellion occurred, you know, this was an outgrowth of decades or years, at the very least, of nonviolent direct action protests and very little changes. And I think that's another reason why this kind of post-King period is so key, because that's when we really begin to see the politics of the Black freedom struggle really shift from a politics of nonviolence to one of self-defense. The idea is that, and especially for, you know, the young people who really sustained and fueled the rebellion. In fact, rebellion was the most widely adopted form of protest among young people after King's murder. They had watched the civil rights movement unfold and watched the nonviolent direct action protests that steered the civil rights movement unfold throughout their childhoods. And by the end of the decade, they were still being, you know, the rights and the inclusion that the movement was all about had not succeeded for many. Their conditions hadn't changed. And now they were being policed in new ways. Their communities were being policed in new ways, instead of getting the major the resources and the structural intervention that civil rights activists and Johnson's own Kerner Commission recommended. They got the war on crime and police. And so, you know, the rebellions were very, very much tied to the shortcomings of the civil rights movement, civil rights legislation as they were experienced, and a response to the growth and the expansion of American police forces in targeted communities.
Let's talk about that road not taken with the Kerner Commission. Yeah. Because I feel like that is the only thing I remember, not quite exactly contemporaneous, but would be the Moynihan Report, which is sort of not the Kerner Commission.
No.
But it's interesting that the Kerner Commission is also one of those things that's just sort of like memory hold. And talk about what that commission recommended and what happened with those recommendations. Although I think, like, spoiler alert, nothing, but go ahead.
So Johnson calls the Kerner Commission in the middle of the Detroit Rebellion to evaluate the causes of the violence that had rocked the nation during every summer of his presidency, and to suggest solutions to prevent rebellion in the future. And, you know, this really allowed Johnson to appear as if he was taking firm action in the middle of the chaos and the destruction in Detroit. And the Kerner Commission released its recommendations in February 1968, several months before the Safe Streets Act passed. And they said, OK, if we not only did they draw the nation's attention to the role of white racism. You know, the famous lines from the report are the nation is moving towards two societies, one black, one white, separate and unequal. But they said, if we're really serious about preventing rebellion in the future and dealing with racial discrimination and inequality in this country, then we have to go far beyond the war on poverty. We need a major structural intervention. We need a massive infusion of resources into low-income communities of color, which means that the public and private sector are going to need to mobilize, is what the Kerner Commission recommended, to create jobs for the so-called disadvantaged. That was the term that was used at the time. Public housing needed a massive upgrade and overhaul. Public schools needed major investments in order to provide low-income children opportunities to go to college and more educational resources. The programs of the war on poverty, like Head Start, needed to be expanded, according to the Kerner Commission. And political and economic institutions would need to commit to really fostering full political and economic inclusion for Black Americans. I mean, essentially, the Kerner Commission reinforced the demands of both the mainstream civil rights movement and many radical organizations at the time. And Johnson, when the report came out, never commented on it publicly, distanced himself from the recommendations, and went on then shortly thereafter not to support a job creation program for low-income Americans of color, but the job creation program for police that was the war on crime.
And we should say, this is, you know, the commission was headed by, I don't know if he was former governor at that time of Illinois. And I mean, it's just to read about the Kerner Commission is sort of fascinating in that, like, it's very hard to imagine a commission coming out with that sort of like explicit of a roadmap today, right? That it would be that, you know, I mean, presumably there were politics, you know, back then, but that it would come out with such an explicit roadmap and such a very clear directive. And yet it being buried so easily, it seems like, I mean, maybe that was a function of the time. You know, I just try and imagine, you know, what would happen if such a commission, you know, if Joe Biden called for such a commission and, you know, 6 months later, they came out with those type of proposals, like,
they surely would.
I mean, I wonder if you could, you know, if you wouldn't have already fashioned a commission that would not come out with those proposals or would be a little bit more mealy mouthed today, by the nature of our politics. I mean, but maybe that's impossible to. So where did Moynihan, when Moynihan came in, where did that fit? Because we have this sort of like cycle going here that is sort of inching forward and progressing at one point. Like, how does Moynihan's recommendations fit into that?
So Moynihan is such a central and fascinating, but also infuriating character throughout this whole period, right? Because he gets his start in government in the Kennedy administration and the Department of Labor, and then he becomes a special advisor to Richard Nixon. And in many ways, he oversees the very developments that we've been talking about. Moynihan's recommendations were actually the ones that were taken up. Moynihan essentially recognizes the kind of the socioeconomic factors that explain Black poverty and disparate rates of Black poverty in his 1965 report on the Negro family. But he also said, ultimately, you know, Black poverty is not about this, you know, socioeconomic inequality, but it's about Black pathology. It's about what he called the tangle of pathology that had been passed down from one generation to the next since slavery. And this kind of pathological assessment of Black poverty gave policymakers a way out. Johnson's Council of Economic Advisors said, oh, okay, well, if Black poverty is the result of pathology and not structure, we can fight the war on poverty relatively cheaply, because then what we need to do, in the words of Johnson's Attorney General Ramsey Clark, who's considered, you know, one of the great liberals of this era, he said, you know, the war on poverty is about helping the disadvantaged help himself. It was, you know, conceived by the federal government as a self-help program. This meant remedial education programs, not the, you know, complete transformation of urban public schools, as the Kerner Commission and others suggested. This meant not job creation programs, but job training programs. And this lack of structural intervention that was deeply influenced by Moynihan's analysis really limited the possibilities for the war on poverty, which is why, one, I mean, socioeconomic conditions hadn't changed and rebellion persisted through Johnson's presidency and beyond, and also why the Kerner Commission said, okay, we have to go much further. Moynihan then went on to, you know, reflecting on the 60s to say, and rebellion and the persistence of rebellion, to say, you know, well, maybe we've gone too far. We need a period of benign neglect, he wrote to Nixon in a 1970 memo, where we don't focus on race at all. And you know, the he extended that pathological analysis to his understanding of Black criminality. So, you know, then by the late 60s, early 70s, alongside the persistence of rebellion and rising crime rates, you know, criminality becomes seen as something that is latent within Black communities, and that can only, again, be cured or solved by arresting criminals and potential criminals and locking them up for long terms.
I mean, is there anything that has had more durability than Moynihan's theory that this is a pathology? I mean, we see this, it seems to me, in every president that we've had there. Yep. I include Barack Obama in this, like, right? Yep. I mean, it's this is your brother's keeper or whatever his program was. This is, you know, it has been a brilliant tactic to avoid dealing with the sort of material necessities that would address this. So we leave that area of that era of the crucible of rebellion, and you're right, it shifts into, we see this rebellion only in specific instances of misjustice, if you will. We see it in LA following the Rodney King riots. We see it in Miami in 1980, which was a particularly violent rebellion. Talk about Cincinnati 2001, because I feel like that got lost in the other events in 2001.
Right.
And where that is, and if that represents also another pivot.
Yeah. So Cincinnati, I mean, the way that I see Cincinnati is a real kind of turning point between the kind of earlier period of rebellion in the late 20th century and what we're seeing now. So Cincinnati, the city of Cincinnati erupted after a 20-year-old black man named Timothy Thomas was shot by a Cincinnati police officer. And Thomas was the 15th black man killed by Cincinnati police within a 5-year period. None of the police officers who had been involved in these killings had been tried, convicted, or held accountable. And when the police department refused to release information about the circumstances that led to Thomas's killing, the people of Cincinnati rebelled. They, you know, for several days, you know, what we typically see, people began to throw objects at police officers. They burned buildings. They marched. I mean, this was a mix of both nonviolent and violent demonstrations. And afterwards, or as the rebellion was beginning to subside, the mayor at the time, Charlie Lukin, called in the Department of Justice for what we're seeing now, what we saw in response to immediately after Derek Chauvin's verdict, and a week after that, to the killing of Breonna Taylor. And that is a pattern or practice investigation by the federal government, which is a new mechanism introduced by the 1994 crime bill. One of the silver linings of what is one of the most draconian pieces of crime legislation in U.S. history. That and the Safe Streets Act, I think, are the kind of two key pieces of federal legislation that help us understand mass criminalization and incarceration. But the pattern of practice investigation allows federal monitors and investigators to enforce or to kind of push a department towards reforming its use of force standards and discriminatory policing practices. And usually this involves a federal monitor remaining in a city under question for a number of years. I think now that the federal government has supported about 70 or so pattern or practice investigations, and they remain really like the only recourse, the only route to get accountability. It requires this kind of a federal intervention. But even these pattern or practice investigations are highly limited. So, you know, the one in Cincinnati, the police department was extremely resistant to it for a number of years. But eventually, after extending the period of investigation to 8 years, the department did manage to reduce its numbers of misdemeanors and police killings. But even, you know, this reform for many people in Cincinnati, especially people of color, didn't change their everyday actions with police, and it didn't stop police killings. In 2015, a 43-year-old man named Sam DuBose was shot by a Cincinnati University police officer who happened to be wearing a Confederate flag shirt under his uniform at the time, and who, after two hung juries, was not convicted for the killing, which was caught on a body cam. So, you know, Cincinnati kind of represents this pivot in terms of the nature of protest and the nature of federal response to, again, exceptional incidents of police violence, where a pattern or practice investigation leading to a consent decree is often called. We saw this in Ferguson, in Baltimore, and now pattern or practice investigations are underway in Minneapolis and Louisville. But again, you know, the reforms in the end, and these investigations end up usually pumping more money into local police, because it costs upwards of usually $500 million to actually implement the reform. So it always marks another investment in police, instead of, you know, again, rethinking our punitive priorities in general. And I know I sound like a dead horse, but going back to the kind of robust crime prevention program that the Kerner Commission imagined back in 1968.
Which is just, it is investing in communities.
Yes.
Not
yeah, beyond
in the policing of communities,
exactly.
but in the communities itself. Have we entered it in a different era? I mean, it seems that the catalyst for, I mean, we just had a year or 8 months of the biggest, uprising rebellion that the country has seen in decades. What it's brought about, it seems to me, at least in terms of like material changes, is nominal. You have some cities who are, we've cut our police budget by 5% maybe. And we bought some hotels and we're housing the homeless, or we're shifting some of the responsibilities of the police, which seems to me to be the right direction, but it's barely getting on the on-ramp, as it were. But in terms of the response of people, are we in a different era? And do you think how durable do you think that era is?
So in some ways, so there's a lot of different layers, I think, to that question. I mean, on the one hand, I think, you know, there is a big distinction between the rebellions from the 60s through Cincinnati and what we saw during Obama's second term, beginning with Ferguson. And that is that, you know, from Ferguson onwards, the violence began after, so the violence always started at peaceful protests, nonviolent protests or vigils. And it was only after police came in with tear gas on peaceful protesters with their batons. You know, we saw this last summer in Minneapolis, we saw in Ferguson, that then some of the protesters turned violent. So instead of it being, you know, violence at the very beginning, it is, again, violence in response to police violence. So in some ways, the protests have become more nonviolent and the police violence has been sustained. And I think that's something really important that we're seeing, that's a new development in these protests. And they're much more the violence itself. I mean, the kind of multiracial character of the protests, and the fact that so many of the protests for racial justice occurred in majority white or all white communities is important and highlights perhaps the durability. But the problem is, you know, we have to move beyond police reform, and we have to move beyond the police themselves as a solution if we really, really want to tackle these problems and prevent killings in the future. And I think that's where, you know, bringing about, and this actually gets to a question you asked earlier, which is, or the, or point that you made earlier, which is like, why is it that these, you know, these recommendations that always get made never actually get adopted? And that's because people have been so resistant to making the kinds of structural changes that are going to be necessary. And so, you know, I think the durability depends on, one, keeping the pressure, this emerging protest movement and these emerging coalitions, keeping the pressure on elected officials, because we know that, you know, policymakers don't make changes out of the goodness of the of their hearts. It takes pressure from the people, and an ongoing campaign among hearts and minds to, you know, expand our knowledge and understanding of the ways in which racist policies shape so many political and economic institutions in this country. And, you know, given the pushback that we're seeing now to, you know, even the most basic reforms and to that version of history that centers racial oppression and exploitation, we have our work cut out for us. But, you know, I'm the younger generation makes me hopeful that the people who sustained the protest movements last summer and my students, you know, they came of age during the Trump administration and COVID and these protests. And I think they want to, in their lifetime, they're committed to fighting for a different kind of governance, one that's based on expanding opportunities and equality and not on policing and surveillance that sustains the mass incarceration society that we've been living in since the civil rights movement.
I want to just turn to sort of that concept of just like, you know, what constitutes, you know, abolishing the police in your mind. But before we get there, just briefly, do you think that's a tactic? I mean, it does seem to me that the police being more aggressive in the past, I don't know, 6-8 years in addressing these protests seems to be like a tactic. Like there is an awareness of we need there to be violence, and it doesn't really matter if we start it. We need there to be violence because that violence justifies, at least in the predominant narrative, our existence.
Yes.
I mean, do you think that's a tactic? Because it just seems like, and you know, we should be clear. Police departments talk with each other. They have conferences. They get together. They share this these strategies.
You know, I think it's complicated. I think that police officers see themselves as threatened and under attack. And I don't know how conscious of a tactic it is, but I think especially, you know, since Michael Brown and the protests in Ferguson and the rise of the Black Lives Matter movement, I think police officers, again, lacking a really nuanced understanding about policing and the way that that the logic of policing has functioned historically in this country to advance the social control and surveillance of people of color. Police officers see their own livelihoods in danger and also see the low income communities of color that they're charged with protecting supposedly as the enemy and as latently criminal. And protesters, I mean, we know, you know, protests for racial justice have always been criminalized. We see in the civil rights movement, nonviolent demonstrations, the responses, German shepherds and hoses. And racial justice is seen by law enforcement authorities as a direct threat for reasons why that you say to their own purpose and well-being. And so I do think that there is a genuine feeling among officers that that they're under attack too. But this reflects, again, so much misinformation and divisions within our society where we're unable to see our common ground.
We got to take just a quick break, but when we come back, we'll have 2 minutes. And I just want to, at that point, just like get a broad sense of what we need to do, what the difference between reform and abolish is when we talk about the police. We're going to take a quick break. We'll be right back in just a moment. All right. So Elizabeth Hinton, we just have a couple minutes here, but when we talk about you know, obviously we can pull back from or stop providing military equipment to police departments on a federal level, right? On a federal level, what else can we do besides like cut off funding so that cities have to shrink their police force? Is it enough to shrink it? Is it enough to say like, we're going to have like, you know, we're going to have cops who are going to investigate murders. You can investigate murders, but you're not going to do traffic stops. You're not going to do evictions. You're not going to do like, you just don't need to have that type of contact with the public.
Right. And we're beginning to see, you know, this kind of a model being implemented. So in Ithaca, New York, for instance, the city council and the police union voted in April to abolish the police department and to replace it with the department, what's now called the Department of Community Solutions and Public Safety, which is doing exactly that, which is saying we don't need a uniformed officer with a gun to be the first responder to a number of problems and issues and situations that officers are deployed to. So for traffic stops, you don't need to have a gun. For domestic violence disputes, you don't need to send a police officer. You could send a social worker. You could send, there's a whole host of other institutions that can replace what police officers are doing. And you know, police officers themselves will tell you they don't want to be responsible and they're not trained to be responsible for mental health crises and familial disputes and all kinds of things that because of the shrinking of the welfare state, police are not now charged to do. But I think, you know, again, going back to that critical moment in the 1960s and again, thinking beyond police, you know, there's the funding of community action programs through the war on poverty, through this principle called maximum feasible participation, allowed the federal government to fund grassroots organizations directly under the idea that, you know, people in the community know best how to address the needs of the community. And I'd like to see us return to this policy precedent. I'd like to see in addition to, you know, can not Elizabeth, giving more money to police,
if I could
funding just grassroots organizations who are doing the best work out there.
All right, Elizabeth Hinton, the book is America on Fire, The Untold History of Police Violence and Black Rebellion Since the 1960s. We'll put a link to that at majority.fm. As we wrap up the show, we will see you folks on Peacock tomorrow. And apologies, Professor, we had to sign off from one of our syndicates.
You tried to squeeze in such a big question into. I'm looking at the clock.
I know.
It's less than 2 minutes left.
I know. Well, we have a little more time now to finish up that answer. Let's if we could. I didn't mean to interrupt you, but these grant these block grants.
Yes.
Community
yeah.
programs.
Yes.
And the idea being allow communities to invest directly into areas that they can see on the ground what need to be supported,
right?
And presumably on a local level, the cities will do what essentially Ithaca did, which is we're going to, and I guess it's maybe just a semantics question as to like. We're gonna change the name of our police department and we're gonna shrink its portfolio essentially, and maybe they can work in conjunction with these other community services.
Right.
But and from a federal level, we could do at least the first part of it, right? I mean, we're not gonna be able to change what happens in the context of the cities, but we can provide incentives to sort of change the way that they're doing it.
Yeah, I think we can provide incentives. I think that we can begin to support these community groups that are envisioning and executing a completely different approach to public safety. And, you know, I think, and this is, you know, one thing that's a little bit more controversial, but, you know, instead of thinking about defund, we can think about changing our tax system to create more dollars to fund these community-based cost-effective programs that do have a demonstrated impact on crime and on violence in the most vulnerable communities. I think, you know, what we know is that investing in police and prisons has not worked to foster greater public safety in our most vulnerable communities. That's the lesson of the past, you know, half century or so. And now it's time to try a different set of policy responses to racial inequality and poverty and crime and gun violence in our communities.
All right. Since I have a law professor here, I have to ask this question of you. Do you think there's any type of a potential legal strategies that can go hand in hand with this agenda? It's hard for me to sort of imagine, but are there legal strategies? Are there cases that could be brought that might sort of have some type of resonance within a circuit, a federal circuit or something?
So I do think that lawyers have an important role to play. I mean, it's almost impossible to prove discriminatory intent, but I think that lawyers can file lawsuits and support cases that can expose the deep discrimination within our system, and also to help municipalities as they navigate the kind of legal challenges of what dissolving, as in the case of Ithaca, a police department might look like, and thinking about, you know, how we can roll back some of the, which is already underway. You know, we see drug decriminalization efforts, right? But how we can roll back the draconian sentencing policies that we really saw adopted on a nationwide basis in the 80s and 90s. I think lawyers have to be at the forefront of that and exposing racism and discrimination in the system.
Elizabeth Hinton, thank you again. Really appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. All right, folks. There we go. We're going to head into the fun half. We will put a link, obviously, to the untold history of police and violence, Black Rebellion since the 1960s. Fascinating book. And obviously enjoyed that. Probably could have gone even a little longer. It is what it is, ladies and gentlemen. We will head into the fun half. And when we do, we will take your phone calls. We will take your IMs. Eventually, we're going to maybe read stuff from the Discord. Out. There's a lot of technological. It's all ahead of us, ladies and gentlemen. It's all ahead of us. And you can join us by becoming a member at jointhemajorityreport.com. And you know all the benefits of being a Majority Report member. I run into members all the time. I ran into when I was on the way to Saul's baseball game this weekend. Well, he had two games, so I guess it's. But saw a couple of members.
Folks I ran into.
They said hi.
I ran into one the other day at. Union Street Station, Andrew Yang's second favorite subway station, I guess.
Oh, is that not right?
Really. No. I mean, he said if you saw that Times Square was his favorite subway station. One, yeah. They all are terrible, but Times Square is clearly the worst.
Times Square is the worst.
Union Square is really bad, too, because it gets really hot down there, too.
Yes. Yeah, nobody, everybody's going in 14 different directions. It's the hardest one to manage, although they do have that band that usually plays there. There's usually a band. Yeah. Downstairs in Union.
Yeah, everyone loves that. I love when my podcast, I can't hear anything.
I mean, do you judge it by the station itself? Or I like Union Square because I like Union Square area.
I like Union Square, but it's just in terms of the most subway lines converging, it's never a pleasurable experience. Times Square, Union Square, Penn Station. I like Union Square probably the best of those three because the other two areas are just terrible.
Yeah.
Parts of the city.
I got to say that I do I get into sort of, you know, going from the train to, you know, when you're in Penn Station, there is something sort of exciting about weaving through the crowd at a half jog. I mean, I just for me, I'm always looking, sort of calculating. I'm sharing too much. I'm a running back as I go through there and I'm trying to calculate what's going to be which direction the people are going in. That can get a little fun, but it also can be a little tiring.
Right, right. Just kind of having to dodge or cut so someone's sneeze doesn't get in your mouth, right? That's super, you know,
or
exciting.
Or dodge and cut in such a way that someone's sneeze does get in your mouth.
Well, then you are revealing too much about yourself.
There you go. Don't forget, tune in to Nomi's show today. Don't know who's on it. It is youtube.com/TheNomiki Show. You can find that at youtube.com/TheNomiki Show. And also, what's happening in the Matt Leck universe? I can't look at you when I'm saying Nomiki's name. Matt, what's happening in the Matt Leckian universe?
Well, people might want to check out the replay of my Twitch stream last night at Literary Hangover, where I played Resident Evil Village for about 2 hours. But tomorrow night, Too Smart, How Digital Capitalism is Extracting Data, Controlling Our Lives, and Taking Over the World. We're having Jathan Sadowski, the author of that, on to talk about that book. He's also the co-host of This Machine Kills with Edward Anguesso Jr., who we also had on before. We're going to also talk about how it's good to be a Luddite and how to properly understand Luddism. It wasn't anti-technology. It was anti who that technology was benefiting. And we need to bring that back, folks. So that's tomorrow night.
Interesting.
8 Eastern, patreon.com/leftreckoning to get the post game. But go subscribe. We just passed 10,000 subs. So check that out.
I didn't realize that was what Ludditism?
Ludditism, yep.
Ludditism was about. I did not know that.
Suppressed truth.
Huh. Exciting. All right. 646-257-3920 is the number. You can IM us through the app, which you can get at majorityapp.com and justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code majority, get 10% off. See you in the fun half. Left is best. Jamie and I may have a disagreement.
Yeah, you can't just say whatever you want about people just because you're rich.
I have an absolute right to mock them on YouTube.
He's up there buggy whipping like he's the boss.
I am not your employer.
You know, I'm tired of the negativity.
I'm sorry. I didn't mean to upset you. You're nervous. You're a little bit upset. You're riled up.
Yeah, maybe you should rethink your defense of that, you fucking idiots.
We're just going to get rid of you.
All right.
But dude.
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 You want to smoke this joint?
Yes.
Do you feel like you are a dinosaur?
Some good shit.
Exactly. I'm happy now.
It's a win-win.
It's a win-win-win.
Hell yeah.
Now listen to me. 2, 3, 4, 5 times. 847-906-5014-57. 2, 38, 56, 27. 1/2. 5/8. 3.9 billion.
Wow.
He's the ultimate math nerd.
Don't you see?
Why don't you get a real job instead of spewing vitriol and hatred, you left-wing Limbaugh?
Everybody's taking their dumb juice today.
Come on, Sammy.
Dance, dance, dance.
Ooh. Rand Paul.
I had my first post-coital scene with a woman. I'm hoping to add more moves to my repertoire. All I have is the dip and the swirl.
Fine, we can double dip.
Yes, this is a perfect moment.
No.
Wait, what?
You make under $1 million a year. You're scum. You're nothing.
Excuse me? Fuck you, you fucking liberal elite. I think you belong in jail.
Thank you for saying that, Sam. You're a horrible, despicable person.
All right, gonna take a quick break. I want to take a moment to talk to some of the libertarians out there. Take whatever vehicle you want to drive to the library. What you're talking about is jibber jabber.
Classic. I'm feeling more chill already.
Good. Donald Trump can kiss all of our asses.
Hey, Sam. Hey, Andy. You guys ready to do some evil?
Hitler was such an idiot.
I think I might be a Nazi.
Agree.
No.
Death to America.
Two.
Yes.
Wow.
Wow, that's weird. No way! Unbelievable. This guy's got a really good hook.
Throw our hands up.
Ooh. Wow.
But Sam, I gotta get off.
No worries. I wanna just flesh this out a little bit. I mean, look, it's a free speech issue. If you don't like me...
Hey, shut up!
Thank you for calling into the Majority Report. Sam will be with you shortly.